Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, Illinois, where we have a beautiful sunny day, 75 degrees, the way it should always be, but usually isn't. I'm flying solo again today. Next week, as we've been pushing all along, we've got Tony Saunders, Merle Saunders' son, who's going to be our guest. Rob will be in for that. He wouldn't miss it. Neither would I. Neither should you. It's going to be a great show. But today is really a lot of fun. It's May. Rob and I have talked ad nauseum about the Grateful Dead playing at the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl, and we've primarily been focused on 1992 and the Steve Miller performance where he came out and played the second set with the boys the third day and all the fun they had with that, and Brent carrying Jerry when his string broke, and on and on and on. But it wasn't a one-off. They'd been there in the prior years as well, and so this is 1993. We had seen him there in 91, 92, and then in 93, 94. They just kept going, but I got to a point where it just wasn't feasible for me to keep going out and seeing the shows because I'm not my good Kevin, who has that that karma that lets him go even with multiple kids around. God bless him and God bless his wife. That's a great arrangement if you can find it. I highly recommend it. But we're going to focus on the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl show today. From Las Vegas, Nevada, May 15th, 1993. Before we even get started, one of the more significant things is the opening act, and that would be Sting. Sting as in I used to be in the Police. Sting as in, you know, I'm huge and giant and everyone in the world knows me, and people make fun of me on TV shows, but I'm still richer than them. And an amazing musician. You know, he's earned it the old-fashioned way, and he plays hard and strong. And he was the opening act for the Grateful Dead. There was no moments when they actually shared the stage, but it was fun and kind of humorous. We picked up the show in Chicago when it came through on the summer tour. They would always test drive these summer tours with their opening acts, which became popular in the 90s. They'd always test drive it at the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl. We had seen, like I said, Steve Miller the year before that. And the year before that, we had seen Roger McGuinn. He had been the opening act. And they would go on to have others, Traffic, I think, one year, and a few other bands. So it was always a lot of fun. And Sting open, but because we don't really have any sets with him playing with the boys, we don't really have anything from there. But we do have a lot of songs from that day, and we're going to kick off with the opener, and you hear it as the fans heard it back on 1993. So let's hit it. Make wrinkles, advertise them as creases. Boy, just another one of those great lines that comes out of the minds of Bob Weir and Mr. Barlow as they sit down and create these wonderful wonderful songs for us in Picasso Moon. We've talked about that before. I know Rob and I are both big fans of October 16th, 1989, 16th being Bob Weir's birthday. And that's a show that's at Brendan Byrne. It came out, was released as Nightfall of Diamonds, because they do break out a monster dark star in there. But the show kicks off with my favorite, Picasso Moon. But it's just a great high energy song. It gets the crowd going. We didn't hear it this time, but Bigger Than a Drive-In Movie Ooh Wee is always a lot of fun. And people jump up and down and get all excited. And then, you know, you hope that the boys are on a roll and, you know, really sustain and keep it going. And I think it would be hard to say that on this night they failed that task. Again, this is a show with so many great tunes to pick from and so many wonderful examples that it was just hard to, you know, to find the five or six that we're going to play. It's an interesting show because it was not a particularly long show. It's only a 6-song first set and a total of 16 songs if you count drums and bass. So if you take them out, you know, really only 14. And, you know, this one, you know, probably didn't hit 2.5 hours in total music time. But on the other hand, it was a great, great performance by the Dead at a great venue. And this is a really well done audience tape, so you can pick up audience from time to time. And I don't hear anybody complaining about being there. And everybody seems to be woofing and howling and having a lot of fun. So the boys come out hot with Picasso Moon. They pop into Peggio, and then for Jerry to get a little in. Great Peggio, by the way. And then Bobby comes back and decides it's time to have some fun. And so we get the boys' first really good cover of the night. That's just a treat. The same thing, Willie Dixon tune, interestingly, though, first recorded by Muddy Waters at Chess Records, April 9th, 1964. The Grateful Dead wound up playing the tune 46 times. The first one as far back as November 9th, 1966 at the Fillmore in San Francisco. A few times after that, that year, and then in 1967, a couple of times on New Year's Eve, 1971, and then completely dropped from the repertoire till 1991, through 1995. And in fact, they last played the tune on July 5th, 95 at the Riverport Center in St. Louis. One of the final four shows ever for the Dead. I was at those shows and, love hearing that tune. It's just a special one when you get to hear it. And Bobby does a very good job with it. I really love Vince's keyboards, though, when they're early on in the clip where he's really tickling the keyboards. And just when you're in the middle of a big Dead jam like that and the keyboards are so pronounced, it was always a great thing. Brent was always really good about getting out there, but not too much, just enough to fill in the spaces and, you know, really kind of motivate the crowd. And I think motivate Jerry and Bobby a little bit, too. So, yeah, the same thing. What a great tune. And only 46 times. So, you know, if you caught it, that was great. And if you didn't, you didn't. And it was probably more likely that you wouldn't. But then there was other songs that you did catch that other people didn't get to hear. And that was always the way about doing this. It's hard to believe that it's been 30 years since this show in 93. You know, and time marches on as we will be rapidly closing in on the 30th anniversary of Jerry's passing, 30 being the same number of years that the Grateful Dead played. So that's going to be historic for some people and a real time smack in the head for other people to realize so much time has now gone by, you know, equivalent to the amount of time that they were around bringing happiness and joy to all the Deadheads who were out there listening to them. And of course, as we know, many of those Deadheads like to smoke marijuana, and we have some very, very interesting things going on in the world of marijuana, both on the national level, on the state level. And let's dive in for a minute on some of this stuff, because as always, it's kind of a mixed bag. We have some really good news, in my opinion. Then there's always some news that, you know, you say maybe we could do without, and you would hope wouldn't be the case. And but let's dive in and see where we're at. I sound like a broken record. That's what you're all going to say, and deservedly so, because I say this almost every chance I get to say it. But now we have to say it again, because this is significant. Headline: teen marijuana use has been declining since legal dispensaries started opening, federal CDC study shows. First of all, thanks, a shout out to Kyle Yeager and Marijuana Moment. This is a great website that they put out. And for us, it's a source of a lot of the news that we pull down and we present on this show. MJ Biz, of course, being the other one. And we're always thankful to them and companies like these who really, you know, have a common background, and we're the pioneers in all of this and have been sponsoring the industry's largest trade show for a long time. And it just becomes a go-to place to find out what's going on in the industry. So what's significant about this? We've been saying teenage smoking goes down in states when they go legal. People always deny it, always argue with you about it. Then more studies. This study comes from the Center for Disease Control and Preventions, the CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Survey, that was published last week and found that teen use of all monitored substances, including marijuana, alcohol, and prescription drugs, has decreased linearly over the past decade. Linearly, that's a hard word to say. Linearly. I hope you understand what I'm trying to say there. I'm not my friend Harold, but I try. When it comes to cannabis, what's especially notable about this is that the federal study shows high school student use was trending up from 2019 to 2013 before legal marijuana dispensaries started opening, but has been generally on the decline since then. The first state recreational legalization laws were approved by voters in 2012, with regulated sales beginning in 2014 in Colorado and Washington state. The latest data from the biennial survey shows that 15.8% of high school students report using marijuana at least once in the past 30 days in 2021, down from 21.7% in 2009, and significantly lower than the record high of 23.4% in 2013. So overall, this is a very encouraging and positive health trend that we're all very happy to see. As a result, teens are also reporting lower rates of lifetime marijuana consumption. In 2021, 27.8% of teens said they'd used cannabis at least once in their lifetime, a nearly 10 percentage point drop from 2019, when the rate was 36.8%. Again, the peak lifetime use for marijuana was in 2013, 40.7%, before any states had opened adult use cannabis retailers. The Center for Disease Control, I know that there are some Americans who don't believe anything that come out of places like that. But hopefully on this one, we can put politics aside and just agree once and for all that no community has the right to deprive its residents of legal marijuana or medical marijuana by falsely claiming that doing so will increase teenage smoking. It won't. The studies say it won't. This is a done issue. If people want to try and contradict it, go right ahead. But the facts are what they are. So that goes in the category of good story, and everybody else, please shut the heck up and just be happy that there's a substance out there that adults can use and teens aren't totally glomming onto yet. And if they get to the right age and decide that it's something that they want to engage with, it's 1,000 times safer than them making the decision to engage with alcohol or drink 2 cups of coffee every day, right? Or any of these other ways that we put substances into our bodies on a regular basis that aren't good, but we just don't really think about it all that much. And in the overall scheme of things, marijuana, at least on that list, is going to be more near the bottom of dangerous substances and potential long-term negative health effects. So, you know, these are myths when people try to contradict that, when people try to tell you that you're going to become schizophrenic, that all these other bad things are going to happen. And that's my spin on it. So let's move on. More good news. The Senate committee adds new witnesses for marijuana bank hearing this week, right? We've talked about the fact that this time the plan is that there have been bills introduced in both the House and the Senate to get some form of the Safe Banking Act in that would allow states, that would allow businesses in states that are operating under legal programs to be able to get the benefit of the banking system for one reason or another. And I know Rob and I have talked about this quite a bit, and Rob is very skeptical as to if and when it can ever be passed. And while it's encouraging to see that the Senate is starting off with its own version this time to see if it can come to an agreement and then send it down to the House, which has been so overwhelmingly supportive of this idea, that might be a good way to do it. So the U.S. Senate Banking Committee has added new witnesses who are going to testify at a hearing on bipartisan marijuana banking bill this week. In addition to the top bipartisan sponsors of the Secure and Fair Enforcement Safe Banking Act, an equity-focused cannabis reform activist, a union representative, cannabis financial service company executive, and a leading prohibitionist advocate share their perspective on the legislation and underlying financial services. It's going to be held before the hearing. The Banking Committee Chairman, Sherrod Brown, the Democrat from Ohio, says last week that senators are planning to move quickly on the legislation, from Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat from Oregon, and Senator Steve Daines, a Republican from Montana, bipartisan support in the Senate. Let's see what we can do. So in addition to these two senators, there's going to be other people who are going to testify. The first is Kat Packer of the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition and the Drug Policy Alliance, a former Los Angeles cannabis regulator who now serves as the vice chair of the CRCC and director of drug markets and legal regulations at DPA. Following the reintroduction of the Safe Banking Act last month, she applauded technical changes that were made to promote equity. She has emphasized the need to resolve marijuana banking issues, but to do so in a way that specifically supports communities that have been disproportionately harmed by the war on drugs, which we know and is, again, something that we've talked about. One of the organization's recommendations is to extend protections to minority depository institutions and to community development financial institutions, and was incorporated into the latest version of the bill. The next witness is going to be, and please forgive me because I'm not going to pronounce her name right, Ademola Oyefeso, United Food and Commercial Workers International Union. She is the director of the union's Legislative and Political Action Department. The union organization represents over 1 million workers, has routinely advocated for cannabis reform, including urging President Joe Biden to support legalization alongside other advocacy groups. It's been working to organize marijuana sector workers in legal states, has also pushed for specific priorities in state-level reform, such as labor peace agreement requirements as part of legalization legislation. And then Michelle Sullivan of DAMA Financial. She's the chief risk and compliance officer at DAMA Financial, which provides services to state-licensed marijuana businesses working to navigate the tricky federal regulations on behalf of companies that are seeking banking services, and quite frankly, which company isn't. And then we have Kevin Sabet, Smart Approaches to Marijuana, or SAM. He's the CEO of SAM and one of the leading figures working to defeat legalization efforts. SAM has opposed the Safe Banking Act, arguing that it would enrich the industry and that it potentially be abused by bad actors. The organization has also maintained that, contrary to what the bill's advocates say, it would exacerbate inequities in the cannabis market. Well, I'm not going to hold myself out to be experts along the lines of these guys, but let's just take a look at this, understanding that's from a guy who is speaking to potential changes in the banking institution for an industry that he doesn't believe should be allowed to exist. So he says it would enrich the industry and that it'd be potentially be abused by bad actors. Providing legal banking services cuts down on black market money, which is exactly what we have now when people have to go to the black market or people have to go to private equity and agree to terms that are often preposterous, but they have no choice in order to get the financing they think they need to get up and running, even though they're entering into a market which with 280E, which we're not touching on right now, but we'll get to later, all of these problems. And here's this guy saying, no, regular safe banking would be abused by bad actors. Well, you know, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, but I don't see where he says this. I don't see where he comes up with this. That's like saying that any industry that has regular safe banking could abuse it. Sure, they could, but that's why we have banking regulators, and that's why banks have due diligence departments, and they look into these things very carefully. And so if he's saying we can't trust the banks, then, you know, maybe he needs to go have a conversation with the banks about that. So he says the organization has also maintained that, contrary to the bill's advocates, that it would exacerbate inequities in the cannabis market. Now, this one is really shocking. One of the biggest problems in the cannabis market right now is the lack of money for businesses that are trying to get up and running. If we had a legal banking system where people could go to their local bank and apply for a loan like people have done for ages to get small businesses off the ground, it would be tremendously helpful. It would be regulated. It would be safe. It would be financially reasonable. Otherwise, you're talking about people trying to have to go and tap into private money sources that either they don't know exist or aren't interested in working with them in trying to make their businesses happen. And some of them are dying on the vine because they have no place to turn to get money. So to say that having legal banking services would exacerbate inequities is another thing that I just find very hard to believe. It really kind of defies logic. And I guess you know, certainly I'll be biased and prejudiced when I say this, but knowing what we all know about marijuana, you kind of have to have that frame of mind, you know, to get up and to advocate, you know, against this and for those purposes. But look, again, you know, round of applause for Kevin Sabat for agreeing to come and speak. He knows he's probably not the most popular guy in the room, but I think in order for senators and other representatives, legislators to make fair and reasonable and what they believe are informed decisions, they might as well hear the whole side of the story. And of course, they're certainly free, you know, to evaluate all the speakers' credentials and statements and biases as much as anybody else. And, you know, see what they have to say about it. So, you know, senators on both sides of the aisle are pushing for urgent action on the Standalone Safe Banking Act, again, which would protect banks that work with state legal cannabis businesses from being penalized by federal regulators. There's been some new amendments. Senator Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said at a cannabis rally in New York City that he would bring the bill to the floor after it clears committee, and he emphasized that it would be revised to include expungement provisions, which, of course, is another very, very important part of what we're looking for. There's a lot of other issues tied up in this. It is something that we've been following very carefully. It's something that we're going to continue to follow very carefully. And, you know, at the end of the day, the key is to be able to provide safe banking for this industry so that this industry has a chance to move forward and enjoy the benefits that every other industry in society has. You know, and people are going to say, well, yeah, but marijuana is a Schedule I controlled substance, to which we all say, okay, you know, that's really enough of that, right? We have stories every week about all the positive health benefits that marijuana can provide, treating symptoms, helping people with all sorts of problems, PTSD, the list goes on and on and on, anxiety, things that people get hooked on meds for, you know, the kind of meds that we see, you know, in Dopesick. I'm not saying that every drug company is marketing like that, but I'm saying that when you're dealing with big pharma and drugs from big pharma, they aren't necessarily providing you with the substances that, you know, are the most natural or in that, you know, take all of that kind of stuff into regard. They're marketing pills that they can make a profit on and that I'm sure may very well provide the benefits you're looking for, but at what cost you in terms of what else, what other ingredients are put into those pills and everything else. Again, I take no position on it. I know nothing about that industry, but it seems to me that anytime you can take something natural and herbal like marijuana and it provides the relief you're looking for, why have to go looking anywhere else? So, you know, this is all just important stuff, and it's really important to stay on top of it and follow, and that we will. Let's go back to our Grateful Dead show from May 15th, 1993 at the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl. And in a night of covers, the Dead roll right into their next one, and they do not disappoint as Phil takes center stage.
Could be happy, history. To meet you at the witness tree, leave a horror behind. I wanna come when you call. I'll get to you if I have to call.
Tune from Robbie Robertson from his self-titled album that was released in October 1987. It's been covered by the likes of Rod Stewart, and the Dead started playing it in 1993, February 23rd in Oakland to be exact. Stayed in the repertoire right up until the very end, July 2nd, 95, in Deer Creek. So that's expanding it out to one of the final six Dead shows ever. They played it a total of 21 times in 93, but then they began to diminish, only 9 times in 94 and only 5 times in 95. But for all of us who were going to these shows, it was just another great piece for Phil to take center stage on. You know, Phil really exploded on the scene as a solo performer when he started playing Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues. And then, of course, in March of 86, he brought back Box of Rain. And all of a sudden, it was not uncommon to see Phil at the microphone at a Dead show. And interestingly enough, you know, if you kind of, and I took the time to go through a lot of the songs that Phil ultimately sang on, I'm sure there's a few I'm missing. At the Garden in October 1983, one of the shows that's in the In and Out of the Garden, we go box set. The second night, the night after the St. Stephen breakout, they open with Cold Rain and Snow, and Phil walked up to Bobby's mic and sang on the Out in the Cold Rain and Snow line over and over again at the end of the tune. And we noticed that and got excited about it. And, you know, a year or two later, Tom Thumb's Blues. And then after that, Box of Rain, Phil also voiced the Go Down Miss Moses verse in The Wait, the Maggie's Pa verse in Maggie's Farm, both tunes that have five verses that each person in the band would take a turn singing. And then sometimes they'd all sing one verse together, but that was always fun. And then a bunch of mashups with Brent. Why Don't We Do It in the Road by the Beatles. Gimme Some Lovin' they played. Saw them break that out at the New Year's shows at the end of 1984 out in San Francisco with my good buddy Rick on the third set of New Year's Eve. And they just came out jamming. Phil's bass was on fire that night. It's a great tune. And love to see Phil and Brent doing that. And then, of course, on Brent's song, Tons of Steel, they harmonize on the second verse at the beginning, or right at the end of the verse, I guess. She wasn't built to travel at the speed of rumor flies. These wheels are bound to jump the track before they burn the ties. My favorite part of the song, because he and Brent really have a great harmony going there. That he and Brent also knocked out Keep on Growing, which I saw him break out at the 85 Greek Theater shows, the 20th anniversary shows, with the big, huge crowd out there, Andy and Alex and Larry and everybody, Andy and Steve and Jack, and goes on and on. The great shows, one of the best times we've ever had. And then with this song, Broken Arrow, this is carried over. Phil played it with the Other Ones. I remember seeing it when the Other Ones played the first time after Jerry's death. And then, of course, Phil and Friends, it's regularly in the cycle for that band when he's out touring. And just a great, great song, always fun to hear, and a great cover. But you can't go to Dead shows just looking for covers. That won't work. You know, there's too many of the stuff, too much of the stuff that they play that's so great. And we talk about this first set only being a six-song first set, which it was, but it's an amazing thing when you get a 15-minute killer bird song to close out the first set. So let's listen to a snippet of that for a minute. Beautiful ode to Janis Joplin. as I say, you know, killer 15-minute version to close out the first set, send everybody into the hallways with a big smile on their face. I'm sure waiting for the big second set and where that would take them to. Birdsong is the first tune that I ever remember having a type 2 jam, right, where they get so lost in that deep space in the middle of it that I would forget what song they were playing until they, you know, touch back down at the very end with the Don't Cry Now lead-in, which is really my favorite part of the song. Unfortunately, this version of it, they kind of jammed on it a little bit or jammed through it and didn't hit it the way I like, so I pulled another part of the song. That would really snap you right back to reality. You know, you'd be out there floating, and all of a sudden, Don't Cry Now, and boom, you're like, oh, right, Birdsong. You know, and that, you know, was really, you know, just the way it would be before, you know, they'd move on to the next song and lose you again. And I'm sure that, you know, there's deadheads out there who can testify to having type 2 shows where somewhere in the middle of the show, they probably must have wondered, where the hell am I? Who is this band playing? And, you know, what's going on? They're just taking me so far away. And that's what the Dead did. And they were really, really good at it when they did it. And this is a great example of them doing it. And it's a great placement. On the one hand, I'm not going to lie to you, I don't like Birdsong to close out the set because it never, for me, was a traditional first set closer. You know, I'd like a Birdsong that if they're only going to do seven songs, you know, maybe goes into the Music Never Stopped, right? Or, you know, give Bobby a chance to kind of jam out on that or, you know, throw a Bobby tune in or one of the Cowboy songs and let Jerry play Deal. You know, because those are the songs you think about that would come at the end. And when they close the set with something else, then it, you know, at least for the moment, forecloses the possibility of hearing certain tunes that you want to hear. But that's just, you know, my Grateful Dead nerdism rising to the surface. And 5 minutes into Birdsong, I'm happy as can be that's what they decided to play and enjoying every minute of it, even if it does ultimately lead to the end of the set. But like I say, after a song like that, you're ready for a little break. Go get your water glasses or whatever you're drinking refilled. Take stock of your mental state and see if that needs any adjusting. And then you get ready to dive back in for the second part of the show. And there is more of this show that we will get to in a few minutes. But let's talk about some what's going on with music for a minute. More marijuana news we'll get back to in a few minutes, but I want to dive into some of this marijuana, some of this music news. First and foremost, and I only just throw this in just because it's something that's fun to do and something that's fun to note. Vida Blue, pitcher for the Oakland A's, most notably for the Oakland A's, but also had a great run with the San Francisco Giants later in his career, recently died. And although that's sad, and I was a big Oakland A's fan when I was a kid because the Cardinals hadn't quite proven to me that they could be regular winners, and the A's had really cool uniforms and wore white shoes, which made them, for me and my buddy Mark, the coolest team around. And actually, Mark's cousin Kenny Holtzman pitched for him, so you know that they were our team. But he died. But there's been this band out there for years that I've heard of. I've never seen them. Vida Blue, which is Paige McConnell's band, playing with Oteil Burbridge, Russell Batiste Jr., Adam Zimmerman, a few other people who have probably come in and out and joined them from time to time. The thing I thought that was so cool was back in 2004 at a show at the Fillmore in San Francisco. Apparently they must have worked this out in advance, or Vida Blue was just a big fan of their music because he was there, and they invited him up on stage. And Vida, of course, a big fan favorite in the Bay Area, having pitched on both sides of the Bay, having started the All-Star game for both leagues. I think he was the only one who ever did that. And I also believe he may have been the last pinch hitter to get a try in the Hall of Fame or win the MVP, something like that. Whatever it was, man, Vida Blue was just the bomb. And it's very sad that he's passed away as we get older. And those of us that were alive during that period of time, and our heroes get older too. We miss Vida Blue and condolences to his family. And, you know, hopefully that will not stop Paige and the guys from continuing to play and tour with them from time to time and making everybody happy with the music that they create. In Grateful Dead news, as we roll along from April into May, it means it's time for the second Dave's Pick of 2023. And they release a great show from 1972. September 9th, my good friend Lisa's birthday and my good friend Larry Van Oker's birthday. Larry's been on the show with us along with my other buddy, Larry Rader from New York. And we've all had a great time talking about the Grateful Dead, but This comes from his birthday back in 1972 at the Hollywood Palladium out in Los Angeles. And the truth is, it's just a fantastic show from Promised Land, kicking it all the way through a Johnny B. Goode first set closer, or no, excuse me, a deal closer, and then diving into a second set, opening with Playing in the Band, into Loser, into Johnny B. Goode, with China Cat Sunflower, Friend of the Devil. It just goes on and on and on. And actually, I'm sorry, I had it right the first time. It was a Johnny B. Goode closer. They played 11 songs in the first set. They opened the second set with China Rider. And then, you know, goes all the way through and ultimately finishing with a stellar El Paso. I don't know if they've sold out. They have a run of limited run of 25,000 of them. You can buy a subscription usually in November or October or November for the following year. It's a little pricey side, but not horrible considering you're getting four shows over the course of the year and you don't have to fight the masses on the days when they finally announce them and say, you know, it's being released and there's only a few of them left. But nevertheless, it's a great, great show. I highly recommend getting it or trying to find a place to download it and listening to it. It speaks to a wonderful show from a wonderful era for the Dead, and they're really cranking along at that time with Keith playing the piano, fully worked into the band, and they just give it a great effort. And for those who have the subscription to Dave's Pick every year, this second one, when it's released, is also the time when they release their annual bonus disc. Now, to understand that, back in the day, when they would release shows, it was not uncommon for them to throw a bonus disc in, the primary purpose being that they didn't have enough space on the 3 or 4 CD set to get in all the music they wanted to get in. So they'd start throwing in bonus discs. And then they realized, hey, you know, we can capitalize on this too. So now you can only get the bonus disc if you buy the Dave subscriptions each year. And then you only get one of them. You don't get one with each release, but we get this one. And as usual, it's from right around the same time period as the show on September 9th. They pull some music for from September 3rd, 1972, from Folsom Field in Boulder, Colorado. And then from September 19th, 1972, from a show at Roosevelt Stadium in Jersey City, New Jersey. And it's all some of the great music of the time, music that they had been playing and introducing on their new Americana Dead era, starting with a lot of the music off of American Beauty and Working Man's, other stuff off of Ace, Greatest Story, Bertha, Birdsong we just heard, and then some stuff that was going to be coming off Wake of the Flood and some of their later albums, including Mississippi Half Step. And others, a great China Rider, really fun Truckin', and just really, really good stuff. Very much worth it. And they're playing it a lot on the XM Dead station right now, so you might want to check that out too as a way to pick up some of the tunes. And I think you will really, really enjoy listening to that. But it's not just the Dead that's releasing stuff right now at this moment. Garcia Live Volume 19 has dropped. And has been released. I just received my copy, a show from October 31st, 1992, at the Oakland Coliseum. Now, this show represents Jerry's comeback after his second coma from 3 months earlier. The first coma was back in 1986, right before the summer tour, when he slipped into a diabetic coma, almost died, and then came out and had to relearn how to play the guitar, so the story goes. But by the fall of that year, he was back on stage, coming back first with the Jerry Garcia Band, and then ultimately making his appearance in Oakland at the Coliseum in early December before rolling into those New Year's shows of that year. So same thing here, kind of. He had gone into his coma during the summer, came back, slimmed down, sounded much better, clearly had a lot more energy. And unfortunately, it wouldn't last for long, but at least on that night, it was awesome. And he came out and really, really put on a great show as he rolled forward and what would ultimately be the last loop from 92, ultimately right into 95. And then that was it. And on this night for Jerry, if you can get your hands on this disc, and I don't think that this one was released in a limited edition. I think it's out there and you can get it. And he covers How Sweet It Is by James Taylor, You Never Can't Tell by Chuck Berry, and also well known from the Pulp Fiction Dance Contest with John Travolta and Uma Thurman. Covers The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, written by Robbie Robertson, covered originally performed by Robbie and the band. Lay Down Sally from Eric Clapton, and It Stoned Me, Van Morrison. What a Wonderful World from Bob Thiel and George Weiss, which was recorded by Louis Armstrong in 1967, and people know that song very well. Waiting for a Miracle by Bruce Coburn, Tangled Up in Blue by Bob Dylan, and it being Halloween night, you know Jerry's going to play Werewolves of London to close it all out by Warren Zevon, and he does, and it's another fantastic performance of a great tune. He does throw in a killer deal as just to make sure that we get a really hot Jerry number in there, and really, I don't know what else you could want from a Jerry Garcia show. This one's just fire from start to finish. And very, very strongly recommended for people who have either heard the Jerry Garcia Band and missed those days or never had an opportunity to hear the Jerry Garcia Band. And you'll really want to have an opportunity to hear what they missed out on. And, you know, if you put it on in your house and turn off the lights and dance around, I'm sure that it's not quite the same, but you can have a wonderful transformative experience with it. And it's the perfect music for that kind of a thing. So Garcia Live Volume 19. From Oakland Coliseum on October 31st, 1992. But now back to the Dead, because it being this time of the year, early May, they've now come up with their program of their annual box sets. Last year it was In and Out of the Garden, the Madison Square Garden shows of the early 1980s. And now they've announced that the next one is going to be called Here Comes Sunshine, and captures five shows from May and June of 1973. We've often talked about 73 being one of the really, really prime years for the Grateful Dead. Some people think of it as the greatest year or one of the greatest years in conjunction with 1977. Of course, there's other good years out there that people love, and rightfully so, because they're all really pretty good. But 73, there's no doubt that is kind of universally acknowledged as a peak year for the Grateful Dead. And these shows speak to that era and are, you know, you could have picked any five shows from that era, I think. And, you know, I could have given them five shows that I love that aren't even these five shows. But I've already ordered it, and I'm very excited to get it and be able to sit and listen to all of this. 17 CDs total. They have Des Moines, Iowa from May 13th. Santa Barbara, California from May 20th, 1973. San Francisco, a show in Kezar Stadium in Golden Gate Park from May 26th, 1973. And then two shows from Washington, D.C. and RFK Stadium on June 9th and 10th of 1973. And that's really pretty significant because 73 is still relatively early in the band's post-Primal Dead era. And to be playing a place like RFK Stadium is just a huge venue where we saw him play well into the 90s. And, you know, I think that's very impressive that there were promoters out there who felt comfortable enough booking them into such a large venue and you know, probably selling quite a few tickets for that. So these are all five wonderful shows from that era. They capture all of the classics and all of the special tunes, the speeded up version of They Love Each Other, all sorts of stuff that they're doing, the introductions of Eyes of the World and things like that that are first coming out and really making an appearance. And, you know, I think that it's a great opportunity. Yes, most of it's probably available online, and most of you probably know how to get it that way. I'm just a sucker for good packaging, and I like all of the booklets and all the pamphlets and information and read it so much that, you know, like I say, you know, Rob and I hold ourselves out as kind of anal Grateful Deadhead nerds who know the most arcane trivia, and that's because we sit around and we read this stuff. But it's a lot of fun. The packaging is always very pretty. Put it out in the living room, and people always compliment it. So looking forward to getting that one a little bit later this year when it's finally released. And, of course, you know, really the key to all of it, I think, is that it was recorded in combination by Kid Candelario, Betty Cantor Jackson, who we've talked about, Mary Durex Jackson, and, of course, Owsley Stanley, the Bear himself. It's a limited edition, only 10,000 copies being offered. So if you want to have the box and you want to have all of the fun stuff that comes with it and the really nice disc so that someday when the entire power grid crashes and all of the backup cloud banks empty of memory, those of us with the discs and the, you know, the originals will still have a way, and everybody will have to come back to us to repopulate the web. And I'm sure we'll do it for a price. But I would go ahead and order this, or at least find a way to listen to some of it, or just start listening to 1973 on archive or re-listen, or whichever streaming service you go to listen to your live Grateful Dead, if you're not buying the stuff from them. But 1973 is just filled right across the board. Spring tour is great. Summer tour is great. Fall tour is great. And there's wonderful examples from all of them. These just happen to be favorites of the boys, and I'm sure Dave's. And so this is what we're seeing. When I get in and I can read his introduction, I'll find out a little bit more about why he loves them so much. And we can come back and talk about them at that point and even be able to give you a review on them. But just great stuff that the Dead are releasing. They continue to release. They're releasing stuff on vinyl. So much of it out there. Is some of it excess? Yeah, probably. But again, for those of us that like the stuff, we can't get enough of it. And very, very excited that this is what they're doing. Now, we can talk about the Dead all day long, but we got to go back and listen to some of it. So we're going to go back in and listen. And I picked this particular song, if you will, or part of a song for a reason, which I'll talk about in a minute, but you fishheads probably know why. So go ahead, Dan. So to speak fish, this was the original twee pry long before there was even a tweezer, long before there was even a fish, maybe even long before Trey picked up a guitar. I have no idea. And I love tweezer, and twee pry is always a lot of fun. Tweezer repry, you know, and playing in the band reprise, I think, is what probably launched it, you know, certainly for adherents of rock and roll at that time and fans of the Grateful Dead. And it's always wonderful to see it incorporated into other band songs, and Fish plays it just as much in a fun way as the Dead do, you know, because with the Dead, sometimes it would actually just be at the end of playing, right? They would just play all the way through playing, have a good long jam and pop it in there. Sometimes they would do playing into another tune and then come back into the playing reprise, you know, and they could do it that way, which, you know, is always fun because, you know, then you're getting that little sandwich around it and everything. And, you know, who doesn't like this? In this case, actually, that's exactly what they did with Crazy Fingers. They came out of the second set with a great Here Comes Sunshine into playing in the band, almost 10 minutes of jamming, getting lost in the middle of everything, Crazy Fingers. And then right as we picked up on the tape there, the do-do-do-do-do-do, boom, and they're right back into playing in the band, you know, with a vengeance and wrapping it up so that they would do it as a song sandwich sometimes later in the set or maybe even in the next set if it playing showed up in the first set, which it did from time to time, sometimes as an encore or a second encore, though not very often just because there were not a lot of second encores with the Dead, sometimes later in the same run of shows and sometimes at a show later on the tour. You never knew, and that's why you went to all of them, miss a little, miss a lot. And it was always fun if you heard the playing and realized that they had dropped the play and repry. It was always fun to try and guess the show where they were going to do it. And if you can manage to be there, that was even better. And sometimes you just had to accept you're not. And sometimes it was nice. You were on the other end. And even though you missed the playing, you got the repry and had a lot of fun with it. So good stuff. Love it when they do it. And yes, there were times when they didn't do it at all, but mostly they did, and it just keeps everyone happy. And it, you know, it serves that same purpose as tweezer repry. It kind of pulls you back into the mindset you had earlier in the show, as now you're getting more towards the end of the show, And it's just a way to go back and tap back into that same energy and really get people going. One or two more marijuana stories, and then we're going to come back and wrap it up with the encore from this Dead show, which is a wonderful encore and another great cover and a song that I love, and I'm very happy to hear them playing it. More good marijuana news. Now, let's dive into this for a minute. The state of Washington has passed a bill, and the state governor, Inslee, has signed a bill to protect job applicants from anti-marijuana discrimination. So Jay Inslee signed this bill. It will protect workers from facing employment discrimination during the hiring process over their lawful use of marijuana. At a signing ceremony, he gave final approval to the legislation, enacting the bill into law about 3 weeks after it cleared the legislature. The reform is limited to job applicants. As he noted before signing the measure, employees will still be able to maintain a drug-free workplace or prohibit the use of cannabis by workers after they are hired. Now, that's problematic for me. If you're going to say that we can protect people and that they can't be denied a job because they've smoked marijuana, then why does anybody care if they smoke marijuana away from the job? Employers are entitled to a drug-free workplace. I make no argument against that. If it's your business and that's what you prefer, that's great. Sometimes safety demands it. Sometimes other things demand it. But, you know, we're all flexible about everything, and something has to be flexible there. But if you know that somebody smokes marijuana and you're willing to hire them anyway, but later on you're going to penalize them for smoking marijuana, even if it's not on company time, to me that seems very, very problematic. So I think that this is a start. It's not a final solution to these problems. And look, like we've talked about before, employers have to act at their own risk. And I think this is a much bigger risk for an employer than an employee. And people will laugh at that. Oh, the employer still has the business. The employee is out. Yeah, but not so fast. You know, depending on the type of business you have and the nature of the types of people you have for the jobs that you have, you know, you're a law firm and you have a bunch of, you know, young urban professionals who are working with you. There's a good chance that a few of them smoke marijuana. Shouldn't be surprised if that happens at all. And if you say we're going to have a zero drug tolerance policy here in the office and somebody tests and you got to get rid of them, what if three of them, what if they're all at a party together or at a Grateful Dead show together and they all test positive? Are you prepared to cut out a third or a quarter of your workforce over something like that? Hey, look, it's your business. If you are, God bless you. But, you know, hopefully the idea is that you recognize that it's really kind of silly, because we always talk about, right, presence versus impairment. If they're not impaired, if it's just present when they show up and that's the day you decide to test, you're really doing yourself and them and everybody a big disservice if that's going to be the basis for getting rid of them. Again, it's your decision to make. Right now, the law says that you can do it if you want, but you know, you have to take the risks that go along with it. And if it means a decrease in your customer service performance, then I'm sure you'll feel it in the pocketbook. And you can always go back and reevaluate that stuff. So employment always remains a fraught territory for people in this industry. But at the end of the day, it's one we have to work on. And it's nice to see at least that Governor Inslee and the state of Washington are taking first steps in that regard. And now just a quick state roundup, because there is a lot going on in all over the states, and we'll try to move pretty quickly with this and get back to the music to wrap up so we don't take up too much of your precious time. And thank you for making it this far with me today. It's been a fun show so far. And let's see what's going on around the country. In Arizona, the state Senate approved psilocybin research grants as part of a budget to study medical potential of psilocybin mushrooms. $5 million is the amount allocated for the study, and a related health-focused budget measure that also cleared the chamber details requirements for the clinical trials that these dollars will support. So they're doing a lot of the rulemaking as well so that they can get this thing up and running. Recognized conditions for treatment, since this is a medical program, would include PTSD, depression, anxiety, long COVID symptoms, and substance abuse disorder. It's not being legalized, but people who receive grant money and work on clinical trials will be explicitly protected from prosecution by the new law. So I think that's a step in the right direction for something like that. And immediately we turn back to the state of Washington and Governor Inslee, who signed a bill to create a psilocybin therapy pilot program. The program will provide therapeutic access to psychedelics for mental health treatment. Pushed back on the Washington governor pushed back on a broader bill that would have legalized psilocybin, allowing folks 21 years of age and older to access the psychedelics under the care of a licensed facilitator. want to allow access to it for military vets and first responders, again, in treatment of PTSD and mood and substance abuse disorders. Because as we've talked about, sometimes psilocybin and marijuana can be very good for getting people off of far more dangerous things like opiates, heroin, alcohol, and other substances that are abused to the great detriment and great harm to the human body, far greater than any that have yet to be proven to be caused by marijuana or psilocybin. So, you know, as we've also talked about on psilocybin, I can't slam governments for going a little bit slower with that, because anyone who smoked one joint too many, one toke over the line, as we like to say, versus somebody who's taken a few too many grams of mushrooms, I think most people will agree when I say that the additional impact on you of having taken too much mushrooms can be far more devastating than having smoked too much marijuana, where usually you can just fall asleep or turn on a TV program and be fine. But if you've eaten too much mushroom and you're out there and, you know, wandering around on the night, you know, at a party, not sure where you are, or, you know, even if you are sure and, you know, trying to make heads or tails of your surroundings, you know, mushrooms have the ability to distort that reality. I think it's very important, and I would agree that certainly for a starting point that they be limited to medical application, and then we can let healthcare professionals, you know, come out and give us examples of ways that they can be packaged and produced, you know, maybe in pill form. I know people that like to do it that way. You can get psilocybin in chocolate bars now, and there's quite a few different ways for it to be manufactured and packaged and presented to the public, but it is much more psychoactive and has the potential to make your disassociation with reality stronger and longer. So kudos to the states for stepping into that pond, and you know, for the rest of us for having patience to let them do it the right way, so that we can have an opportunity to take advantage of it to the extent we either need to medically, or to the extent that they ultimately say it can be used for self-help purposes for medical things. In Florida, a marijuana campaign has collected enough signatures to qualify for a legalization initiative on the November 2024 ballot. It was announced by Trulieve, which is financially backing the Smart and Safe Florida campaign. They needed 891,523 valid signatures. To date, the state has verified for them 786,688 as of the end of April. They've already gotten enough signatures to initiate a state Supreme Court review of the measure's language submitted by the state's attorney general. The state Supreme Court will look to make sure that the text of the proposal doesn't violate the state's constitution's single subject rule and isn't affirmatively misleading to voters. If the court determines the proposal meets those standards, then the measure will qualify for ballot placement once enough signatures have been verified. It looks like they're well on their way to getting that done. Don't forget, Florida's the state that's allowing Circle K to partner up with GTI and create dispensaries at all of these Circle K locations, at least on the Florida Turnpike, if not in other places. Right now it's for medical, but if this adult use passes, that could be a wonderful thing too, and would really be a big step in the right direction in terms of making marijuana available to the public overall. On the other hand, we go out to New Hampshire, which I always like to think of being right next door to Vermont and Maine, and, you know, being a little more liberal, but they're tough out there, and their senators are signaling that the marijuana legalization bill is going to fail when it comes to the floor for a vote. The Senate Majority Leader noted that the House passed a bill which will be defeated after a key committee voted against it last week. There's no sign yet of any amendment to legalize cannabis through a state-run model, kind of like the way they run their alcohol. And interestingly, Governor Chris Sununu, who is a Republican, but in my opinion tends to be a little more center than far right, said the state should only consider the policy change after the state has addressed other drug-related issues. You don't legalize drugs for money, he said. That's not why you do it. You do it because of harm reduction and the opportunities for citizens. Well, I get the point he's making, but yeah, you do it to legalize for money, because it's not just creating jobs and improving your economy, it's creating more tax dollars for the state. So, you know, to try to pretend like that's not really going on, I think is a little disingenuous. But on the other hand, it sounds like New Hampshire has far bigger problems to work on, you know, before they become a situation where their citizens are going to all the other nearby states to take advantage of the marijuana that's available there, thereby depriving New Hampshire of tax dollars that every state needs these days, you know, because they want to take a stand for reasons that they want to take a stand, which takes us to Missouri, my home state, and they continue to come up with very interesting stuff. The operators are pushing their back against the proposed labeling and video surveillance rules that the state wants to implement to comply with the state constitution that marijuana labeling shall not be made to be attractive to children. The state is proposing plain or uniform labeling, like with cigarettes and medicine. The state claims that such packaging increases attention to and perceptions of harm and reduce social appeal. So it's kind of like, look, if we put plain or uniform labeling on there, it gives it more of a medicine feel. It's not attractive to kids and certainly not as attractive to adolescents. The proposed label change is not a surprise to the Missouri companies. It had been talked about for a while. The companies must also have electronic video monitoring with high-def cameras throughout the building that can be accessed remotely. The industry is pushing back on this as much as they can. Money and all that kind of surprising about the cameras. Those have always been a part of Illinois licenses for a long, long time. So it's nice to see that Missouri is requiring steps that will increase the security and the safety, not just of the people who work in these facilities, but the public that visits them to make purchases. Now, what's interesting is that notwithstanding all of this pushback in Missouri, operators being concerned what it might do to the market, in just in another amazing set of numbers, they've sold $350 million worth of products since recreational sales were launched 3 months ago. That's $91 million in April this past month after $93 million in March right before that. Now, the totals do include medical sales, but cannabis business owners think the number are going to be much, much higher because larger companies are not yet operating at full capacity on the cultivation side. But they know as of yet they still cannot satisfy consumer demand, which is big. By contrast, it took Illinois 7 months to hit $300 million. Now, it won't catch Illinois. Missouri won't catch Illinois' expected $1.6 billion for this year, which may even grow larger as more and more of these new dispensaries come online. Missouri is still poised to hit $1 billion in sales in year one. Illinois' first year ended with only $670 million. Missouri is just going gangbusters, and it's wonderful to see. It's, you know, again, like I say, one of the things for my home state, besides being a big Cardinal fan and enjoying Anheuser-Busch beer. Sorry, Kid Rock, but that's just the way it goes. You know, it's great to see them, at least for right now. And, you know, there's always an opportunity for anybody to screw things up. But for right now, they're doing it right with marijuana, and that's great. Two quick final stories, because my producer is giving me signals that says we've got to stop. Nevada sports regulators have sent a proposal to the governor to stop penalizing fighters over marijuana so that they don't want them to be penalized if they're tested and shows they've been using or possessing marijuana in compliance with state law. Even if they use marijuana in a different state, it's still protected if their use would have been compliant under Nevada law. That's great. Athletes like to use marijuana. This needs to be implemented by all sports leagues and all organizations that monitor athletes. And finally, you know, keep your fingers crossed and let's see what happens. New Jersey's governor signed a cannabis tax bill to decouple the state tax policy from federal provisions, thereby allowing marijuana companies to deduct ordinary business expenses on their state tax filings. They still won't be able to do it on their federal filings, but they will be able to do it on their state tax filings. And of course, we'll see if the IRS tries to stick its nose in where it doesn't belong. That would be a great thing if the state could do that. I'm not enough of a tax expert to know what the net tax effects on it would be, but hopefully it would be positive and every positive dollar will help the industry continue to thrive. So, wow, it's been a great show today. Can't believe the time has flown by, but we're talking about great stuff, stuff that's fun to talk about. And nothing's more fun to talk about than amazing Grateful Dead shows like May 15th, 1993 at the Sam Boyd Silver Bowl. And after a great show with lots of great covers, lots of great Dead classics, we get to the end of the night, and which we're going to listen to here in a second on our way out the door. But what's amazing about it is it's a Beatles tune, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, no surprises here. That's a song that was released on May 26, 1967, almost 56 years ago. Think about that and feel old for people who have been listening to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds their whole life. And the story behind it is fascinating. Everybody just believes that Lucy, so LSD, Sky Diamonds, was the Beatles code for singing about the joys of LSD to the world. But John Lennon said that his inspiration for the song came when his three-year-old son, Julian, showed him a nursery school drawing that he called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, depicting his classmate, Lucy O'Donnell. Julian later recalled, "I don't know why I called it that or why it stood out from all my other drawings, but I obviously had an affection for Lucy at that age. I used to show Dad everything I built or painted at school, and this one sparked off the idea." Ringo Starr recalls witnessing the moment and said that Julian first uttered the song's title on returning home from nursery school. John Lennon later said, "I thought that's beautiful. I immediately wrote a song about it." So shortly before the album's release, again, the speculation arose whether it was referring to LSD, the initialism commonly used for what we all know to be the hallucinogenic drug. Lennon repeatedly denied that he had intended it as a drug song and attributed the song's fantastical imagery to his reading of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland books. A song that was long rumored and always wished for by Deadheads, the Dead wound up playing it a total of about 20 times, first on May 17th, 1993 at the Cap Center in Landover, Maryland, which may have housed some of the best Grateful Dead shows of all time. And the last time, also very close to the end, was June 28th, 1995 at the Palace of Auburn Hills, just outside Detroit. It's a beautiful song. The Dead do it great. It's a great way to end a lovely Grateful Dead show and a wonderful podcast. Don't miss us next week for Tony Saunders. It's going to be great with wonderful stories and fantastic music. Have a great week. Enjoy yourselves and enjoy your cannabis responsibly. Thank you.
Picture yourself at a train in a station with plastic horns, with looking glass tires. Is there at the turnstile a girl with kaleidoscope eyes? Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hey there, my name is Leah Babruti, and I'm the founder and host of Canna Chicks Podcast, where I discuss cannabis, psychedelics, and other natural medicines. I not only interview people who use them as treatment for different conditions, but also the entrepreneurs who share their knowledge on how they built their businesses. If this sounds interesting to you, give my show a listen. I'm sure you'll learn something that'll surprise you.